together this morning. It was just Spider. I guess he wanted to read the Bible. It's good to be with you, and do have several visiting with us, as is already mentioned. We're glad that you're with us. We are encouraged by your presence, and we hope that we can, first of all, be an encouragement to you, but also bring glory to God together in our worship, and that all that we do will be pleasing to Him, and that we can be edified as a result of our time together this morning. We just read from the book of Nehemiah. We're going to be continuing our theme, looking back to the Old Testament, and we're going to look at Nehemiah today, and we've been studying this, began our study this morning, the first quarter, or really it's the third quarter, but the next two quarters, focusing on the 17 periods of history. And one of our goals of that study is to be able to fit, know where different things fit into the various parts of the Bible. So if I were to say Jeremiah, that might come to mind, that particular period where he would reside. Or if I were to say Nehemiah, which we're going to talk about tonight, or this morning rather, we might know that would fit into the return of captivity. After Judah had been taken captive by the Babylonians, they were in captivity roughly 70 years, and then we start to see them return. And there's a couple waves of return, but Nehemiah is among those who sees that, or hears a report, as we just read a moment ago, that the walls of the city of Jerusalem have been destroyed and they're lying in ruin. Ezra, in the book prior to this, he led the people in rebuilding the temple. And then Nehemiah sees that the walls are in shambles, and so he leads the people to rebuild the walls. And there's a great deal of, there's some great lessons that we learn from Nehemiah. I would suggest there's great leadership lessons that are to be learned from the story of Nehemiah. And especially as he rallies the people to rebuild the walls, and they do so in 52 days. They've been sitting in shambles for years, and in 52 days he gets the people to rebuild the walls. And so I want to think about a few things regarding Nehemiah, what makes him successful in what he does, and how that can relate to us being successful in the Lord's kingdom as we are seeking to labor together in the work of the Lord and continuing to do the work that God has given us to do. And so I want to begin by noticing that Nehemiah is a man who cared. One of the reasons why Nehemiah was able to be successful is because he cared about what it is that he was involved in. As we read there in Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 4, it says, "It happened that when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days." And by the way, he's not even in Jerusalem at the moment. This is just a report of the condition of the walls of Jerusalem. He hears about it and he begins to weep. Now, there are people in Jerusalem at this point, and they don't seem to really notice or care about the walls that's supposed to protect them being in shambles. And yet Nehemiah begins to weep at the news that this is where the condition of these walls. Care is where things will begin to take place. When people care, things will get done. When they don't, things won't get done. And that's just a study of human relations. That's just how things work. When people care about things, then things are going to happen. We hear that expression, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. Because somebody cares enough to make enough racket to get something, to cause something to be done. And so people care. When people care, things tend to get done. And Nehemiah cared for the city where the temple dwelled, where the place of God was dwelling. And so he knew the significance of Jerusalem, and to see it in ruin was distressing to him. And so as we bring this into the New Testament, we need to have the same care for the kingdom and his local congregation that we are a part of. I'd say his church as a whole, but also the local congregation that we might be a part of. We find in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 28, Paul is describing many of the hardships that he endures as an apostle of Christ. I'll begin reading here in verse 23. As he says, "Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as if I am insane. I more so. In far more labors, in far more imprisonments, in beatings without number, in frequent danger of death. 5 times I received from the Jews 40 lashes less one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been spent in the deep. I have been on frequent journeys, in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in desolate places, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. I've been in labor and hardship, in many sleepless nights, in starvation and thirst, often hungry and cold and without enough clothing." Now that's quite a difficult time that Paul is dealing with there. But he says in verse 28, apart from such external things, there's the daily pressure on me of concern for all the churches. And I would say if Paul is making a list of, you know, what he's most concerned about or what is most distressing to him, I don't think that long list that we just read would be at the top. I think verse 28 is at the top. His concern for all the churches. Paul cared about the Lord's people. He cared about the churches, and that's why he went about to encourage them, to strengthen them, to teach the gospel to them. And that's why he continues to write letters to them to encourage them to continue in the way that they should go. And so we need to care about the Lord, first of all. I think that one's pretty obvious. We need to care about his people. We find in 1 John, this will not be on the screen, but we find in 1 John that if we love God, we love those who are begotten of Him. We love His people. And we can broaden that to describe that all, in a sense, all people come from God, and so we should love all people. But we love those who are of God. And there needs to be a care. Do we care when we see a lack of growth, both numerically and spiritually? I'm not trying to point to anything that I've observed, just a general question. If we notice that in ourselves or in our brethren, do we care enough to be an encouragement to them and to try and help lift them up, to help them to grow? Do we care when we see brothers and sisters maybe overtaken by worldliness? Maybe they seem to be really faithful and strong, and now they seem to be drifting a little bit. Do we care enough to encourage them to walk with them? If something is wrong, we need to show care. Rather than sitting back and waiting for someone else to do something about it or just letting them drift away, we should care enough to help. Now, Nehemiah cared, but not only did Nehemiah care, he cared enough to do something about it. And so the rest of the next several chapters of the book of Nehemiah show that he did something because he cared. And so care is where action is going to begin. When we care about the Lord's church, about her purity, about her influence, we will be moved to action, both to live in a way ourselves that will bring glory to God and to help to maintain her purity in this world. So Nehemiah, first and foremost, is a man who cared. We also find, if we back up to Nehemiah, he is a man who prayed. In Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 4, Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 4, it says, "He wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." Prayer is Nehemiah's first response. Not only when he was told about the condition of Jerusalem, when he stands before the king, he prays. I think it's really interesting what we read here in Nehemiah 2 and verse 4. It says, beginning in verse 1, he's there with King Artaxerxes. He's the cupbearer for King Artaxerxes. And it says he was sad, and it says, "I had not been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, 'Why is your face sad, though you are not sick?' And then it was, 'This is nothing but sadness of heart.' Then I was very much afraid." Because if the king doesn't like your disposition, he can say, cast him out, or even worse, off with his head. "I said to the king, 'Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste and its gates have been consumed by fire. Then the king said to me, what would you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Now, if you're in this situation, is prayer the first instinct? I think if it's not, it should be. And so prayer should be something that is a constant part of our life. Prayer is something that is valuable and vital to our lives and should be an important part of our lives. But if we back up to chapter 1, we see the content of the prayer of Nehemiah, what he prayed for at that moment when he realizes or sees that the walls of Jerusalem were still in ruin. Beginning of verse 5, Nehemiah chapter 1, he says, I beseech you, O Yahweh, the God of heaven, the great and fearsome God who keeps the covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments. He begins with a prayer that glorifies God, acknowledging the goodness, the greatness, the majesty of God. He is the great and fearsome God, and he's faithful because he keeps his covenants. He speaks of the goodness of God. And then he goes on to speak with humility. Let your ear now be attentive to your eyes, or attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your slave, which I am praying before you today, day and night, on behalf of the sons of Israel, your slaves, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against you. I and my father's house have sinned. We have worked in utter destruction against you and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the judgments which you commanded your servant Moses. So he begins with that, acknowledging the goodness of God, and then immediately begins speaking with humility. He's not presuming upon God to hear. Well, you said you're going to listen, so I expect you to hear me. He says, let your ear be open and attentive. He's petitioning God to be open, to hear him. And then beyond that, he begins to acknowledge the failures of Israel. This is a prayer of confession, but not so much for his own personal sin, but rather a collective sin of the people. We have sinned. That's kind of why we're in this position in the first place, why we were carried off for 70 years into captivity. But he's acknowledging and praying on behalf of his people. You want to think about a prayer of a good leader. It's not like Saul, well, I wanted to do what God said, but they wanted to bring back the stuff to sacrifice. He says, I and my father's house have sinned. We have sinned. And so he prays collectively on their behalf. But then going on into verse 8, it's a prayer that's based upon God's promise. He says, remember the word which you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been banished were at the ends of the sky, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place where I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. They are your slaves and your people whom you redeemed by your great power and your strong hand. So he's reminding, not that God needs to be reminded, but he's acknowledging the very promises of God. We've already noted there in verse 5 where he describes God as the one who keeps his covenant. This was your covenant. On a negative sense, he says when Israel would be unfaithful, then great calamity would have come upon them. And that's exactly what happened. We see that with the northern tribe of nation of Israel, and then the southern tribe of Judah didn't listen to the or pay attention to the lessons, and they were carried away too. The very things that God promised back in Deuteronomy happened. But then he's leaning on, in verse 9, the goodness of God. Yes, we have sinned, we have been unfaithful, and you have been just, and you have been faithful to your word by scattering us among the peoples. But you've also said, if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, you will receive us. And so he's praying based upon the very promises of God. And then with all of that in mind, he prays a very specific request in verse 11. O Lord, I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your slave and the prayer of your slaves who delight to fear your name, and make your slave successful today and grant him compassion before this man. We mentioned when King Artaxerxes says, what's wrong and what do you request? He says, I prayed. He prayed before he even went in. And he prays that God would grant him success and compassion before the king. I think taking some time to really study the prayer of Nehemiah there would be very beneficial to help in our personal prayers. Another good prayer would be the prayer of Daniel. I believe it's Daniel 9. I'm not entirely sure there, but that's very similar. That kind of construct there does a lot of the very same things. A wonderful prayer to consider there. But we find another element of this prayer is that it was accompanied by waiting. Notice from chapter 1 and verse 1, it happened in the month of Chislev in the 20th year, and I was in Susa, the capital. To chapter 2 and verse 1, it happened in the month of Nisan in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. 4 months have taken place between verse 1 of chapter 1 and verse 2, or verse 1 of chapter 2. And this is a demonstration of trust as prayer causes us to pause. We find in Psalm 27 in verse 14, Psalm 27 in verse 14, we find here, hope in Yahweh, be strong and let your heart take courage, hope in Yahweh. The concept of hope, of course, is something that we don't have and we're waiting for, especially waiting patiently for. In Psalm 40, verse 1, I hoped earnestly for Yahweh, and he inclined to me and heard my cry for help. We find a trust that is involved in prayer that is important, causing us to pause and wait for what it is that we are praying for. Because we want things to happen right now. I want to pray and I want God to just snap his fingers and then poof, all my problems go away. But it doesn't work that way. And so we pray expecting that God can and will provide. And then we show patience in waiting on God to do what it is that he is in promised to do. And so we want to, as Nehemiah does, we demonstrate our trust in God as we wait patiently for him to answer. But then also prayer helps to clear our vision. Taking things to God helps us to gain a better and a higher perspective. And this is not on our screen here, but if you flip over to Psalm 13 for just a moment, we may have talked about this one before. At the beginning of Psalm 13, and I think this is very much a prayer of David, where David begins in verse 1 by asking, how long, O Yahweh, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart all the day? How long will my enemy be exalted over me? And I think David is struggling through whatever it is he's dealing with, and he's praying, God, how long are you going to leave me here? How long are you going to, in some words, abandon me? And that's really what the first four verses are talking about. And then you look at verse 5. I have trusted in your loving kindness, and my heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to Yahweh because he has dealt bountifully for me, or with me. What we find there is David praying to God for deliverance from his oppression. And he's kind of wondering, how long are you going to leave me here? But then he concludes it by saying, I will trust in you. And so we find as he takes things to God, it helps to enable him to rest in the goodness of God. Even if he isn't immediately delivered, he could still rest in the fact that God has dealt bountifully with me. Even though I've been praying and he hasn't immediately answered me, I can rest knowing that he has dealt bountifully with me. And so prayer can help to clear our vision and it can help to quiet our hearts. A verse that has really become a lot more valuable to me over the past few years is Philippians 4 and verse 6. It's connected there with verse 7, where Paul says, "Be anxious for nothing." And in a society that's gripped by anxiety, that might pique our interest. Be anxious for nothing. "But in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus." There's a song that says, "Bring your burdens to the Lord and leave it there." That's essentially what he's saying here in Philippians 4 and verse 6. Don't be anxious. Take that petition. Bring that burden to the Lord. Do so with thanksgiving. He says the peace of God will surround your hearts. It's not just saying that you can have some peace. It says it guards your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Prayer can help to quiet your heart. There's been times where I've been anxious about various things, and I've stopped and prayed, and usually by the time I'm done, I feel better. Now, those are just minor anxieties. I know there's some people that deal with major anxiety struggles, and just a simple prayer doesn't always help to ease that, but it can help. And I don't want to just say that if you're struggling with anxiety, just pray more and it's all going to be okay. I'm not that naive. But some of the minor anxieties that we deal with, especially the minor anxieties that we deal with, that prayer is the way, the means that God has given us to deal with those. Because it helps to quiet our hearts so that the peace of God can help guard our hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Now, how much are we praying for the church? Broad, very broad, as a whole, how much are we praying for this local congregation? How much are we praying for the kingdom to increase, to flourish, to thrive? Praying that God's will be done through the church. Prayer is a vital part of our lives, and it is an effective tool for the people of God. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. And that's not just a cliche. That is that is spoken from God Himself. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. And we need to believe that. Nehemiah was a man who prayed, and we see the success that leads him to. We want to be people of prayer if we are to be spiritually successful as well. We also find that Nehemiah is a man who had a plan. If we back up to Nehemiah chapter 2, we noted the first few verses a moment ago where Nehemiah stands before the king, and the king recognizes that he's sad and asks him what he needs. And so Nehemiah doesn't just say, well, the walls of Jerusalem are in shambles, and he says, well, what do you need? Well, I guess I hadn't really thought about it. I'm distressed, but I don't know what to do. No, he goes to the king and he has a plan. It does say he prays in verse 4 to the God of heaven. And in verse 5, I said to the king, if it is good for the king and if your servant is good before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may be rebuild it. He's not just aimlessly, there's something needs to be done. He says, if you are okay with this, send me back. I'll go back and I will rebuild the walls. I will help to rebuild the city of my father's tombs. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will your journey be and when will you return to me? So it was good to the king to send me, and I gave him a set time. And I said to the king, if it is good to the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress, which is by the house of God, for the wall of the city and for the house to which I will go. And the king granted them to me because the good hand of my God was on me. Then I came to the governor of the provinces of beyond the river and gave them the king's letters, and the king had sent with me commanders of the military force and horsemen. Then Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it. And it was very great evil to them that someone had come to seek the good of the sons of Israel. Now there's a few more things there. But we find the plan that Nehemiah had in place. The king says, what do you want me to do? Or what do you want to be done? And he says, well, send me back. And I will go and rebuild it. And he says, okay, how long? Well, this is how long I will need. And then also, if you could send letters with me to help ease my way as I journey back, that would go a great deal in helping me. And so we find Nehemiah had a plan. But Nehemiah goes back to Jerusalem, and he doesn't just waltz in the city and say, all right, let's get to work. It says first in verse 11, I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days, and I arose in the night, and I and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my heart to do for Jerusalem, and there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So I went out by night by the valley gate in the direction of the Dragon Spring and on the Dung Gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the Spring Gate and the King's Pools, but there was no place for my animal to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I turned and entered the valley gate and turned around. And so Nehemiah has a plan, and he walks in and he starts to institute that plan, not by just hounding on the people to get to work, but he starts by inspecting it for himself to see what the condition of the wall is and the work that first needs to be done before he even approaches the people. It says there was nobody that knew. I did not tell anybody, verse 12. And so Nehemiah had a plan, and he went about instituting that plan in order to accomplish the work that he was intending to do. We find if the Lord's church is going to thrive, or if it's going to grow, we need to have a plan and move forward with direction. I've said this before, but I think it's absolutely true and profound. If we aim for nothing, we'll hit it every time. And a church that fails to plan, plans to fail. We find in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 9, Paul says that we make it our aim. And of course, he's talking within a context of judgment here. As he's about to describe that we're all going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ, he says we make it our aim to be well-pleasing to Him. That idea of aiming is there's a goal that we're working toward. There's a fixed point that we're reaching toward. And so he says our aim, our ambition is to be pleasing to Him. That's where we're going. Now, once we figure out where we're going, we can start talking about how we're going to get there. But having a plan is critical for any success. And I think there's many churches that aren't growing because they simply are existing and not planning to spread the borders of the kingdom. We want to make sure that we're formulating plans and acting on those in order to accomplish what it is that God wants us to do. We find in Proverbs 21 and verse 5. Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 5. Planning is wise and will lead to success. It says here, the thoughts of the diligent lead surely to profit, but everyone who is hasty comes surely to poverty. And that is a principle that I think we see listed in the book of Luke, chapter 14, where Jesus is talking about the importance of discipleship and what is involved in being a disciple. And he says, no king is going to sit down and to wage war without considering whether with his 10,000 men he can go against the other king who has 30,000 men. And I don't remember the exact numbers there, but you get the point. And he says nobody's going to build a tower without sitting down to consider the cost of the tower. Because if it costs $100,000 and he only has 75, he can only complete it so far, and then people are going to laugh at him because he couldn't complete it. What he's saying is they need to have a plan before they they start acting or start doing something, knowing, acting with the end in mind. If you read Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, one of those seven habits is beginning with the end in mind. That's called having a plan. And we read there in Proverbs 21, that leads to profit. Surely in a business sense, that leads to profit. But we want to have plans, but we want to have plans that are centered around the Lord. James 4 talks about making plans. And it almost sounds like James says that we don't want to ever make plans, the way he talks, when he says in verse 13, "Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away." And James is not saying don't ever make plans for tomorrow because you don't know if tomorrow will come. But what he says in verse 14, it says, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. Now, that doesn't, you know, we often say that sometimes, next week, Lord willing, we're going to do this, or we're going to go here, we're going to do that. I don't think that James is saying that throwing that in as a magic formula is exactly what we have in mind. What he is saying is that the Lord needs to be a part of the plans that you make. You need to include the Lord in everything that you do. And I think that's what Nehemiah does. Remember, he says he's inspecting the walls and he says, I didn't tell anybody what the Lord had put into my heart to do. He's planning, but he's praying alongside of those plans to ensure that God is with him as he plans. Now, we need to have plans if we're going to be successful. And that's true in any area of life. A plan is vital if we are going to be successful. And so if we back up again to the book of Nehemiah, chapter 2 and verse 18, we find Nehemiah was a man who was motivated. After Nehemiah had formulated his plans, he rallies his people to begin working on the walls. It says, I told them, I'll begin in verse 16, the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, nor had I yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest of the who were doing the work. Then I said to them, you see the calamity we are in, that Jerusalem lies in waste and its great gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the walls of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. And I told them how the hand of my God had been good to me, and also about the king's word which he had said to me. Then they said, let us arise and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. Nehemiah doesn't just come in and beat them over the head and say, y'all lazy people, let's get to work. What he does come in and say, he says, look around you, see the calamity in which this great city is in, and I've God has been good to me to bring me here so that we can work together and rebuild the walls. And notice verse 18. What do the people say? Who says, let us arise and build? It's not Nehemiah. They said, let us arise and build. Not only is Nehemiah motivated, but he also motivates the people as well. You've heard before, as I have as well, when you're teaching somebody, if you can lead them to the conclusion rather than just telling them the conclusion, that's more valuable, because if they have seen it themselves, then you know that they're going to receive it. If I just tell them what the right answer is, they're not always going to hear. Nehemiah motivates them to the point that they say, let us arise and build. He kind of allows them to take ownership of this. And we'll see that again a little bit later. But the next chapter details all the people who were taking part in the rebuilding. And I don't have all these verses up on the screen. But we find in verse 2, next to him the men of Jericho built, next to them Zakur the son of Imri built. In verse 4, next to them Meremoth the son of Uriah and the son of Hakaz made repairs. And next to them, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabel, made repairs. And next to them, Zadok, the son of Bana, made repairs. And then in verses 7 through 9, next to them, Melatiah the Gibeonite and Jadon the Meronothite. The men of Gibeon and Mizpah also made repairs for the official seat of the governor of the province beyond the river. Next to them, Uzziel, the son of Harahiah of the goldsmith made repairs. And next to him, Hananiah, one of the perfumers, made repairs. And they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad walls. Next to them, Rephaiah, the son of Hur, the official of half the district of Jerusalem, made repairs. And there's more that we could read there, but we find all these people who are jumping in order to help build, rebuild the walls. And if we're going to thrive as the Lord's church, if the Lord's church is going to grow, we need to work together. Work is always easier when it is done together. And it's encouraging and refreshing. There may be things that are difficult to do, but if you have somebody to do it with you, then it helps. I remember when I was a child and Mom and Dad would tell my brother and I to clean our room. And then, you know, we didn't want to do it, obviously, but, you know, you're working together. At least you're not suffering by yourself. But then you're trying to work here, and then my brother's over there. He finds a book that's been sitting there for months and months and never touched, but all of a sudden it becomes the most interesting book in the world, right? And while he's sitting there reading, not looking, I'm like, well, if he's not, I'm not going to look. And because when people work together, it helps to ease the burden. And so we find him encouraging these people to work together, and the Lord's church will thrive when people work together. We find in Ephesians 4 and verse 16, the body grows when every part does its share. And so if we look back in the examples there in Nehemiah, the result of them working together is the work got done in 52 days. They rebuilt the walls of the city in a mere 52 days. I don't know how long it took to build the walls in the first place, but that's less than 2 months that they were able to rebuild the walls. And that just seems like a pretty impressive number. You think about this street down here. It's been well over a year since this street has been torn apart. And they were able to accomplish this task in 52 days because they worked together. They were working side by side. One person did his part, and they all did what they were capable of doing. And I think we find in verse 29 some of the genius of Nehemiah here. After them, Zadok, the son of Immer, made repairs in front of his house. Now, if this is the wall that is protecting your city and you're responsible for the part in front of your house, how well are you going to make sure and do that job? Because this is directly in front of your house. I'm not going to do a cheap job. I'm not going to cut corners because this is my house that it's protecting. And so we find him giving them responsibility and giving them responsibility that they can really take ownership of. This is protecting my house, so I want to make sure that it's the strongest that it can be. And so they would have a vested interest in the quality of the work that was done on that particular section. We should have a vested interest in the work of the Lord because we are the work of the Lord. Paul describes to the Corinthians that they are his letter. They are his field that he's labored in. And so we are the field of the Lord. The Lord has labored in us, and we ought to take a vested interest in the work of the Lord. And again, every part doing its share will cause the growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. We see how that worked in the days of Nehemiah, that they were able to rebuild these walls in 52 days. We saw that kind of on the other side in Genesis chapter 11 with the Tower of Babel. God saw that they were one people, that they had one mind, that they all spoke the same thing, and that nothing that they purposed would be withheld from them. And if it works for them, it'll work for us. We see that with Nehemiah. It worked for Nehemiah. They worked together, were of one mind, and they had one purpose, and they were able to accomplish what they set their minds to. And so we want to be motivated in order to do the work that God has given us to do. We also find Nehemiah as a man who endured hardship. We read this a minute ago, but in Nehemiah 2 and verse 10, Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, and it was a very great evil to them that someone had come to seek the good of the sons of Israel. I could make a modern application of that, but I'm not going to. You can read into that all you want. Verse 19, Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard it, and they mocked us and despised us and said, "What is this you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" And so they start to mock him and his efforts. We find in chapter 4 and verse 1, it happened that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the walls, he became angry and very vexed and mocked the Jews. So they were able to rebuild the walls in 52 days, but it wasn't just a smooth cakewalk. It wasn't just that he rallied all the people together and they just all worked together and they just knocked it right out and they didn't have any kind of hardship that they dealt with. No, there were people who were actively opposing them. Nehemiah was mocked by them, and they even set a guard to watch for the detractors. If you look in chapter 4 and verse 9, we prayed to our God. There's that prayer again. We prayed to our God, and because of them, we stood a guard against them day and night. And Judah said, "The strength of the burden bearers is failing, yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the walls." Our adversary said, "They will not know or see until we come among them to kill them and put a stop to the work." They're starting to be worn down by it. They're being mocked, they're being pressured, they're being opposed, and they're starting to waver. And yet, Nehemiah is able to get them back to working and to continue to build the walls, and they do so in 52 days. The reality is we're laboring in the Lord's kingdom. There's going to be detractors. And mostly, I think those detractors can come from the world. Sometimes there may be detractors that come from within, and those sometimes are the most hurtful, but we must ignore them and continue to about our business. We expect opposition from those who are without. That's a given. Jesus says, "They hated me, they're going to hate you too." And if we're going to align ourselves with Jesus, we're signing ourselves up for opposition from the world around us. But when that opposition comes from within, we need to keep plugging along. And we need to keep doing the work and not allowing ourselves to be discouraged. I know that's easier said than done, but keep pressing on and keep plugging along and keep doing the work that God has given us to do. While criticisms will come, we must not allow it to cause us to stop. We find in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and beginning in verse 21. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 21, Solomon writes, "Also, do not give your heart to all words which are spoken, so that you will not hear your slave cursing you. For your heart also knows that you likewise have many times cursed others." I think what he's saying is, don't take it to heart too much when people say things about you. You've said bad things about other people. And so don't get too bent out of shape when people say things about you. Just keep going, keep moving along, keep pressing on. And don't give your heart to all words which are spoken. You don't have to attend every argument that you're invited to. And so sometimes people are going to be contrary. Sometimes people are just cantankerous by their very nature. But I don't have to align myself closely with them. I don't have to be their best buddy and allow their cantankerous nature to draw me down. I don't have to pay attention to every word that everybody says. I can keep pressing on, because my greatest focus is not what everybody else thinks. My greatest focus is what the Lord thinks. And if I'm pleasing to Him, as I think you see throughout Nehemiah was pleasing to God. And he says, "I prayed to God and He allowed this." And God was very clearly with him throughout this whole story. And that's all that mattered. That's all that mattered, is that God was with him and God was blessing him, and he kept going. And so when hardship and difficulties and trials come, keep pressing on and just don't quit. And finally, Nehemiah was a man who took action. Do you ever see something that's gone on? Sometimes it might be in the church. Sometimes it might just be in society where we see problems and you just kind of throw a pity party about how horrible things are and how terrible our condition is and how much we wish things would be better, and we're just moaning and groaning and nothing's ever changing. That's not what Nehemiah does. He doesn't throw a pity party and start whining and griping about how bad the things are in Jerusalem and how he's so far away and that I wish that somebody would just take action and do something. He says, the walls are lying in ruin, and that's grieving to me. I will do something about it. He took action, and the result was the walls being built in 52 days. When Nehemiah heard about the condition of the walls, he didn't pawn the responsibility off on somebody else. Rather, he had a here am I, send me attitude, Isaiah 6. When God says, well, who am I going to send to go preach to the people? Isaiah says, here am I, send me. That's the kind of attitude that Nehemiah has. I will go. And sometimes people have a problem and they start looking around. Well, who's going to take care of it? Who can we find to do this for us? Whereas sometimes the most effective person is, I will take up the charge. I will grab the banner. I will do it if I am capable of doing it. And so we find Nehemiah simply being a man who took action. There's a story. I don't have it recorded for me. But I'm sure you could find it easily with a simple Google search. It's kind of a funny story, but it's also a really sad story because it's a really true story. And it's a story about everybody, somebody, anybody, and nobody. And how everybody had a responsibility to do something and nobody did it. And everybody got mad because anybody could have done it, but nobody did it. And it just goes on and on. It's really kind of comical, but when you actually think about how that is reality, it's less funny. But it does illustrate our point. Somebody needs to take action. And not the somebody in the story, but someone has to get up and do something. And Nehemiah had to get up and do something in order to cause the walls to be rebuilt. And he was able to revive the stones and the walls be rebuilt. Nehemiah 4 and verse 2. At the end of the day, we can plan, we can pray, we can motivate, but we have to get busy and be about the Lord's business if anything is going to happen. Luke 2, in verse 49, we find Jesus and his earthly parents had come to Jerusalem for worship, and they depart and they go a day's journey and start looking around and realize that Jesus was not with them. And so they return to Jerusalem, and it says that they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. He's 12 years old at this point, by the way. And all who heard him were astounded at his understanding and his answers. And when they saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, child, why have you treated us this way? Behold, your father and I have been anxiously searching for you. And he said to them, why is it that you were searching for me? Did you not know that I had to be in my father's house? Some of you virgins say that I must be about my father's business. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, it says that we are a chosen family, a royal priesthood, a special people, a people for God's own possession, so that we can proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called us out of darkness and into His marvelous light. He's saying you are a chosen people of God, but that's not just a title that you can just wear or put on a resume somewhere. He says that's a role that you have that has a responsibility attached to it, to be workers in the Lord's kingdom, to do the Lord's business. I must be about my Father's business. Nehemiah was a man who took action. And we find the faithful people of the Bible are the ones who took action when they saw that something needed to be done. David, among others, one of the greatest stories that people think about from the Bible is that of David and Goliath. Why did that happen? Because nobody else in Israel was willing to stand up to Goliath. But David said, I'll do it. I'm sick and tired of listening to him blaspheme the name of God. Somebody's got to do it. And if nobody else will, I'll go take him on. And God will deliver me. We see faithful people are people who take action. We find the entire book of Hebrews 11 is of people who acted because of their faith. And so if we're going to be successful, we simply have to act. We have to do something. And it doesn't have to be grand, like slaying the giant. Just a cup of cold water in his name given. It can be something so small that we think is something so small. It can be great in the kingdom if we only act. Again, read Matthew 25, the very end of Matthew 25. Those who were blessed are those who took action. Even in small ways, I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me a drink. We need to be people of action. Nehemiah is an example of a man of faith, and he was able to accomplish a great task because he trusted in God and he took action. And if we follow the same path that Nehemiah had, we'll be able to be successful in the Lord's kingdom too by applying those very same principles to our lives and acting in the very same way. And so let's resolve to be busy in the Lord's work, to be active in the Lord's kingdom, to do whatever it is that we can find to do. 1 Corinthians 12, whatever your role may be, whatever your gift may be, use it to the glory of God. And go about taking your talents and growing them and expanding them and being the best steward of what God has given you that we can be. And if we can encourage you in any way in doing that, we'd be glad to do so. If you need to obey the gospel and to begin to become a part of the Lord's kingdom so that you can begin walking with him, we'd be happy to help you to become a part of the family of God this very morning. If you need to be baptized, have your sins washed away, and be raised up into new life, the water's ready and able for you to become part of the kingdom of the Lord. And if you are a child of God in some way, you haven't been walking as you ought, then we can encourage you in that as well. We're here to walk with you and to pray with you and to answer or to help you as we all walk together towards our spiritual home. The question that stands above me says, where will you spend your eternity? That is a reality that we all face. We're going to spend eternity somewhere, and because of Christ, we can spend eternity in the glory of heaven, in his presence forevermore. He's bidding us to come to him, to take advantage of all the spiritual blessings that are found in him. And so if you need to respond to that invitation, we'd bid you to come while we stand and sing together.